defund the police, reparations, housing as a human right. 5 years ago, how would you have thought about these concepts? How do you feel about them today? While many might have considered such notions radical in years past, conversations around these matters are becoming increasingly frequent today. With the widespread expansion of the Black Lives Matter movement, several cities, school districts, and public institutions are considering abolishing policing as we know it. And an idea that once floated on the horizon of our imaginations is starting to feel more like reality. I'm Sushma Raman, and this is Justice Matters. I'm humbled to welcome Angela Glover Blackwell as our guest for today's episode. Angela is the founder and residence of Policy Link, an organization that embraces the mission of advancing racial and economic equity for all. Through her writing, speaking, and leadership, Angela has helped to grow and define a national equity movement focused on innovating and improving public policy to ensure access and opportunity for all low-income people and communities of color. Prior to founding Policy Link, Angela served as Senior Vice President at the Rockefeller Foundation. She's also the host of a podcast, Radical Imagination, that I highly recommend. Angela, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to join you.
Before we get started, I'd love for you to share some highlights of your very impressive career in policy advocacy on behalf of communities who are most left out by public processes and policies. So we'd love to learn a bit about your work at Policy Link, as well as your current work with Radical Imagination.
Thank you. I actually started Policy Link 21 years ago in January of 1999, after working at the Rockefeller Foundation, having started another organization called the Urban Strategies Council that was a community building policy group in Oakland, California. And for 10 years, I was a public interest lawyer at Public Advocates in San Francisco. And actually all of that went into starting Policy Link, which is a national research and action institute advancing racial and economic equity. And our tagline for many years was lifting up what works, because we actually believed that local leaders or national leaders, they're solving the nation's problems. And that if you were paying attention, the way residents are defining the challenge, the way local advocates are working to create solutions, you get very authentic policy ideas that often had not informed national policy, even when it was moving in the right direction. Sort of that nuance and grounding that comes from policy that's cascading up from the ground was often missing. And so Policy Link actually started to literally be a link or connector from the wisdom, voice, and experience of people who were working for change on the ground and the worlds of policy, local, state, and national. Over the 20 plus years now at Policy Link, there were several things that became very important to us. One was not to get caught in one particular issue area, because really advancing equity requires that all of the areas of education and jobs and health and transportation, that all of them had to be infused with the notion of centering the challenges of race and ethnicity in a nation in which people of color were disproportionately left behind. And the interplay of the economy and democracy had a lot to do with how the systems worked, or in most cases did not work. And so we started off early lifting up equity as the way to think about what we were doing, to think about regions. Regional equity became very important to us, looking at how often when we started 20 years ago, you had suburbs that were flourishing and cities that were being abandoned. Quickly, that is reversed. And what we have is cities that are coming back, but the very people who were abandoned in cities are now getting pushed out to communities that are not thriving. And so place was very important to us. As a matter of fact, we thought about and used this phrase that where you live in America is a proxy for opportunity. And that's not just about health, but access to education, jobs, and all of those things. And over the years, we have focused on the very issues that I mentioned, always centering equity, centering race, and getting systems to begin to transform themselves to be responsive.
That's terrific. And I'm particularly struck by your focus on looking at a range of issues, right? Because we don't lead single issue lives. But the two sectors I've worked in most, philanthropy and the nonprofit sector, and now academia, tend to siloize issues, right? You tend to become a specialist. Funders often focus on health or education. They rarely think of integrated approaches. So I'm wondering, as you embarked on this work, what were some of the ways in which you overcame these barriers, and how did you communicate this approach to affect others to think about things in more inclusive ways?
One way that PolicyLink had a bit of a head start in the world of philanthropy in terms of getting them to understand what we were trying to do is that when I had been at the Urban Strategies Council, a number of groups around the country had really advanced the notion of community building as the way to think about change in local communities. And the main tenet of community building was to integrate people and place issues so you weren't working on them in silos, and to be upfront about issues of race, and to try to be able to draw in multiple players, not only residents, but always residents, but residents with academics, residents with elected officials, understanding the way the different sectors had to work together. And so, because we had launched the National Community Building Network and had a number of philanthropic partners, the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Annie Casey Foundation, the Kauffman Foundation, a number, we had funders who understood the interrelationship of these issues, and they were excited about beginning to build organizations that could work across all of those sectors. So, in the beginning, we had some good partners in philanthropy who were willing to step out of their usual way and take a chance. I also found, though, when we started off, that there were a couple of things about our approach that caused pause for some of the would-be partners at the national level. The fact that we had not embraced the equal opportunity, equality language, but had talked about equity. And at that time, it's hard to believe now, but back in 1999, nobody was using the term equity domestically to talk about building a fully inclusive society. And so we had to overcome that. And that took a while. We also were trying to be explicit about race. And in June of 2020, it's hard to imagine that 21 years ago, it was very hard to talk about race in academia, in philanthropy, in the national policy groups in Washington, D.C. And so we were an outlier for a long time. And we had to learn how to build partnerships, how to be able to find some common language and some common ground. But I have found that our sticking with what we thought, but learning along the way, has really not only been good for PolicyLink, but it's been good for the field, it's been good for our partners. We started having national equity summits in 2002. The first one that we had was in Los Angeles in November of 2002, and we got about 650 people. The last one that we had in Chicago in April of 2018, we got over 4,000 people who came. And as I watched not just the growing numbers, but the growing understanding and sophistication about what we were talking about when we said racial equity and how sectors had to work together, and how to really achieve racial equity, everybody has to be pulling in the same direction. You mentioned academia, and we've had some wonderful partnerships with people who work in institutions of academia. And it often requires translation because the way the research happens has rarely been with that cross-sector approach. So we've had to take from the transportation and the education and the health research and begin to talk about how these things intersect. But over the years, once again, I have seen some extraordinary developments in the academy that actually understand this. They're using it as their frame. So everything has changed over a 20-year period. It was a good period to be an activist.
So, in the last few weeks, we've seen the entire country come together around the killing of initially George Floyd, but really that follows a spate of killing of Black people around the country by police and vigilantes over the years, if not decades. And I'm wondering, if you think of radical solutions, what are some radical solutions now to the issue of police violence and killings of Black people in the United States?
We actually have a podcast called Radical Imagination, and we launched it in September of 2019, but it was actually inspired by the Equity Summit in 2018 that was called Our Power, Our Future, Our Nation. And I gave the opening talk, and really talked about the fact that we needed radical imagination to fuel the change that we want, and put forward the ideas that when we really think about the North Star of what do we really need, many of our strategies, particularly those that have been focused on reform, will never get us there. For example, I made the point that we can't build our way out of this housing crisis. We may have to build more housing, but we have empty housing sitting right by homelessness. We need for housing to be a human right and to restructure the way we think about it. Also talked about policing. I've been involved in police reform in one way or another since I started at Public Advocates in 1977. And it came right into PolicyLink, and we have been working on it. And I have had enough runs at police reform to really understand that reforming police will never get us to safe communities because they weren't developed for safety. They certainly weren't developed for safety in Black and brown communities. But I would argue they are not about safety. They're about containment and control. And so in that talk that I gave in 2018, I talked about how we really needed to think about abolishing police. So then when I started the Radical Imagination podcast just 9 months ago, our second episode was on police abolition. And I must tell you, a lot of people pushed back and suggested that I had gone off the deep end. And so it is very interesting now to see how fast change can happen once it begins to really roll in the right direction. And so the conversation that's happening now in terms of defunding the police is the right conversation to have. Do I think that it's going to end up with abolishing police? It could end up with us not using that language anymore. And that when we think about developing something that may have some similarities to police, we might not call that police, and it is going to be funded at a different level, and it's going to attract a whole different kind of personality, and it'll train for different skills. What I do think will happen is if we keep up this momentum, and that's always a big if, but if we keep up this momentum, that we will be getting those resources out of police and getting them where we need for health, for safety, for child development, for the ability to be able to do community problem solving in ways to get the results that we want. I think we're about to see something transformative happen around police and police budgets in this country.
So my understanding is that there are, 18,000 police departments around the country. So I'm wondering, given that statistic and the fact that you have emphasized the role of place and geography in building creative solutions, what are approaches that need to happen at local community levels around defunding the police or reorganizing how funds are allocated versus what is needed on the national stage? Leadership, framing, messaging, and whose role is it to move this forward?
It's everybody's role, and we need everybody to play a role. When you think about all of the municipalities that have police departments, we can't solve this problem police department by police department. We need for the federal government and we need for state governments to begin to set a different tone about the conditions under which resources are going to be available and what kind of resources are going to be available. So we need for the federal government to stop providing support for the militarization of police. And we need for them to be able to set up some different criteria for resources that are available. And we need for states to reimagine what it is that we want to do in this arena. They need to set up commissions at the state level. They need to be able to really pull back on the resources and set a framework within local communities can operate in terms of what they can use resources for and what they can't use them for. And then we're going to have a lot of models of local communities really rethinking for themselves because so much of the local budget goes to police. In California, the municipalities are spending over 60-70% on police and fire of their discretionary budgets. That is just terrible when you think about what is really needed in these communities. So I think once we create these spaces, that a lot of local government is just waiting for an opportunity to do something different with that budget. They have been locked in. They've been locked in by the power of police unions. They've been locked in by the myths that the people in their communities tell themselves about police. People think that they need police, but whenever you need them, they're never there. You know, if people really begin to examine, they will see that there are better uses. And so Municipalities will create some amazing models for how to be able to deal with this. And then smaller jurisdictions will be able to adopt those models, and they'll find that they will not be able to draw down money from the state or the federal government if they haven't done so. So we have to work at all three levels. And I think that really good, smart advocates are going to get into this restructuring because they've just been waiting for the moment.
I know in the past you've discussed ideas that might have been considered radical, but there are now increasing numbers of people who are discussing them. You've talked about housing as a human right, reparations, universal basic income. What are some of the policy changes that need to be enacted immediately to advance racial equity?
You've named some, but there is one thing I'd like to go back and mention about police, because one of the episodes was on advancing peace. And it's about an organization called Advance Peace that started in Richmond, California, but now is working across several different communities. And what they do is they identify young men who have been shooters in community, and they get them into an internship program in which they lay out goals for themselves. And as they begin to meet those goals, they then begin to get stipends. And it's an extraordinary program. And they have reduced recidivism, but the most important thing that they have done is they have reduced death of these young people. And so that's just one example I wanted to offer, because once communities turn their attention into what can they do, it's not just that you can do things to prevent young people from falling into gang activity, even if they are in it. They certainly can have their lives turned around. And Advanced Peace is an example of that. But some of the other areas that we talked about were reparations. Reparations has been around as a cry since slavery ended, but it has momentum now, and it will be very good to be able to follow what is happening on the streets, because people are on the streets of all races and ethnicities and ages, and they are centering Blackness. They are all out there to fight anti-Blackness, to be anti-racist, and to center Blackness in the development of strategies to move forward. This is huge, because we have run away from race. When we have embraced it more recently, people in academia and philanthropy and advocates and policymakers have tried to talk about people who are low income and to center poverty, to be able to talk about people of color and to put people of color into one basket as if one strategy will fit all. And the truth of the matter is that it is the black-white paradigm in this country that developed out of the context of slavery. And I also try to draw this distinction between Native Americans. Natives were killed, land stolen, and isolated. Horrendous. But slavery caused black and white people to live together in the most intimate way, really setting the terms, the protocol of oppression that impacts all people who are vulnerable in this society. So if you're Latinx, if you're trans, if you're a person with disability, if you're Hmong and you come to this country, you fall into a chasm that has been defined by the black-white paradigm. And when we try to deal with the impacts of that, we want to talk about everything but black people and the way that they have been treated. And so that this movement is centering blackness is so extraordinary. And so we are going to now talk about reparations. We can do that. And one of the things that I've been really pushing is the federal government absolutely has to be a leader in reparations, but corporations have to as well, because they have been quite complicit, both in terms of the way that their profits have been made over time. And if you go back in history and come along, you will see that there has been a real disadvantage that has been imposed on people who were black throughout that period. So reparations is an important area, and there's public and private reparations that needs to take place. Another policy that I've talked about a lot with my friend Derek Hamilton at the Ohio State Kirwan Institute is federal job guarantee. Again, nothing new about it, really, nothing radical about it. It happened in the 1930s when we were in the Great Depression, and it has been very hard to bring that topic back, even though it has been very much needed in recent years. COVID-19, this extraordinary recession, if not depression, that we're going to go into, we need to do some job creation. The federal government needs to be creating jobs. We need to have a strategy for making sure people can work, but that when they work, they have good jobs with decent pay, and a federal job guarantee could do that. Another issue that started to gain traction out of the really Silicon Valley, looking at what they were leaving in the wake of the way IT was transforming the economy, began to think about guaranteed income to make sure that you create a floor that nobody can fall beneath. Guaranteed income is something that could work right alongside with a guaranteed job, so that for people who are not able to work full time can still maintain an income at a certain level. So all of these ideas that seemed far-fetched just a few years ago are starting to make a lot of sense. So I'm actually under a wonderful amount of pressure to begin to figure out what remains at the edge, because we are moving so quickly to realize the things that at first required a vivid imagination to think that they could be in place. And it's not required so much anymore.
You mentioned COVID-19. I think the combination of the pandemic and the police killing of George Floyd, which was captured on video in such a gruesome manner, really sparked a nationwide series of protests. And the common thread between COVID-19 and the protests against police brutality is the issue of structural racism in this country. The disproportionate impact of the pandemic on communities of color, but African-American communities specifically, and the long legacy of racist policing in the United States. So as you think of creative solutions as the economy rebuilds and reopens, how do we maintain this momentum? How do we maintain the pressure? How do we continue sparking new ideas and creative solutions?
You mentioned two things, the COVID and the killing of George Floyd. There's a third thing, and that's the vulnerability of our lowest paid workers, both during COVID-19 and the possibility that they will continue to suffer as we come out of COVID-19 and the economy remains depressed. People of color are in the jobs that are least likely to come back. They're in jobs that pay the least amount of money. There's so many things that make people vulnerable. So I do believe it is these three things that have created an unprecedented moment for change in this nation. We have been talking for a long time about health disparities and what's the impact of not having access, not just to health care, but not having access to healthy food, not having access to a healthy lifestyle, not having access to healthy environments. And that was disproportionately people who were Black and brown. Those of us who are in the business of change, it has become just second nature to know that. There are a lot of people who've heard about it, but haven't paid much attention to it. It was laid bare by COVID-19. Well, I will tell you, when it first started, I knew that we were going to see disproportionate people who were Black dying. And I wondered in my mind whether I wanted that to be known or not, because I didn't trust America to continue to care about it if they felt that low-income people were the ones dying and low-income people of color were the ones dying, because we really do have a hierarchy of human value in this nation that controls everything. Some lives are just valued more than others. It is at the heart of what is wrong with the nation, actually. But people began to see it. And the reaction, though it was universal by no means, it was a big reaction of all people feeling that they needed to wear the mask and social distance and go home and stay there to save the other, to save other people. That was a shift for a nation that has grown very greedy and very self-centered. So that began to open up an empathy and a we-ness that we had not seen before. As people began to applaud the essential workers and the frontline workers, and they realized that they were so happy they didn't have to go out to the grocery store and they could even get food brought in, and that they began to see the interconnectedness of the people in the economy, and they began to see, you can't help but see, who's dropping that bag off? It's a Black person, it's a brown person, it's a young woman. I mean, people saw who was at risk for having to do that work. And then the media has been extraordinary. I must say we have had a heyday for the media from COVID right to this moment in terms of trying to tell the truth, trying to show what is really happening, bringing forward the data and the scholars to be able to talk not just in detail about who's getting sick and dying, but who are the workers and what are their incomes like? Do they have full-time jobs? Do they have health insurance? And who's coming back and who isn't? And people recognize, those who can stay home and work remotely, that that is a luxury. People have been happy for it. People have felt their privilege for one of the few times in terms of really having to see it in a stark way. So you've got all that going in the awareness, and then we see this horrendous, awful, vulgar murder of George Floyd. It is the only time in my life that when I watched that video, I knew what it must be like for a Black person at a lynching to be off to the side, watching white people crowded around, looking at someone dangling from a tree. I've seen those photos and didn't ever allow myself to think, what would it be like for a Black person watching that? I realized what it's like for a Black person to be watching that. And people saw that this was their nation, this was their police force, this was their country, and this could happen. This shamed America. It shamed America and it energized young people, and they were out on the streets, and others felt that they could have some relief from the shame and horror and anger they were feeling by getting out on the streets. And people have gone to the streets and it has grown and it has been magnificent. And I predict that it's not going to go away. You ask what will keep it going? Continue to raise awareness, continue to organize, continue to be explicit about what are the facts? What do we need to do? What are the solutions? Continue to expand the ranks of those who are in the movement. Do the work. And don't let people get away cheap on this one. Don't let a corporate funder just put $10 million into a Black community. Look internally. What can you do? Don't let universities just spend a minute thinking about, why don't we give some more scholarships to Black students? No, think about everything that you're doing and everything you could do. Look at your research, look at your trustees, look at your student body, look at the kind of stance you're taking. Don't let anybody off the hook, and vote. Democracy, if ever there was a moment to be able to grab democracy out of the jaws of corporations who have just hijacked it. They have just hijacked democracy. They control who gets elected. They control what policies happen. They have this enormous power to be able to impact public policy. We have to grab democracy back for the people. And the people can do that, but we have to have an agenda, stick with it, get more people to see it, join in. Hold everybody accountable. This is the moment to write the next American story.
Angela, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure.
This podcast is produced at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. Learn more about our work at carrcenter.hks.harvard.edu. And connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. If you like what you hear, you can tune into more episodes on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for joining us.